Dr. Tatum, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Your book's title really brings up the question of self-segregation, you know, choosing to stick with people who are like you. Why is this something that we still see so often with children and adults alike?
Well, certainly it is the case that when you look in racially mixed schools, you will find children of color sitting together, white kids sitting together. And typically you see that among adolescents, middle school, high school. You don't often see it in elementary schools. And the reason I mention that is because it really is a developmental phenomenon associated with adolescence. As you start to think about those critical adolescent questions of identity, who am I? Who will I be? Who will I associate with? How will people view me? All of those questions are really critical for young people who are starting to develop into young adults. And it's during that time that not only are they changing, but the world is responding to them differently. How you respond to a 4-year-old black boy is very different than how you respond to a 14-year-old. You might think the 4-year-old is cute. You might think the 14-year-old is dangerous. And so the cues that those young people are getting from the wider world start to change. And as a consequence, they seek out support from people who are having similar experiences.
In what ways can self-segregation be useful for a community or even an individual's development, and in what ways is it harmful?
Well, let me just say I don't like the term self-segregation. Sure. I don't use it because that implies that there's a kind of separation that is not being shaped by the wider social environment. Mm. It's not just, you know, I want to hang out with these people because I like them, though of course you might, but there are also forces having to do with race and class that are driving those behaviors. For example, when we look at racially mixed schools, sometimes who you're sitting with is determined by your class placement. You know, if you're in the advanced math class, your lunch is going to be at a certain time. If you are in the lower math class, you're going to be eating with a different group of kids. And how students get assigned to ability groups in school is often shaped or influenced by their racial group membership, as well as their socioeconomic status. Even when you compare school performance across groups and find that there are similar scores, you can still see different kinds of assignments.
In the book, you point out that whites are the most isolated group and are, you know, the least likely to come into contact with people who are racially different than themselves. You explain how for people of color, that racial segregation can impact access to social network and really important resources. But what is the impact on race relations nationwide when whites are limited to being in a homogenous group?
When I was born in the 1950s, the U.S. population was 90% white. Today, the school-age population, pre-K through 12, is more than 50% young children of color. And what that tells us about the future is that if you haven't learned how to engage with people different from yourself, you're going to be at a real disadvantage in a multicultural, multiracial United States of the 21st century.
That might be the disadvantage for the white population. Does that have an impact on the broader state of race relations or that conversation about race?
Absolutely it does. I think that the changing demographic impacts the conversation in a couple of ways. In one way, it causes anxiety. If you are accustomed to being part of the majority and then you find yourself in a situation where you're not anymore, that can be a little unsettling. I'm here to say, as someone who grew up in a predominantly white environment, it's not that scary to be one of a few, but let me just say that it is certainly a paradigm shift for many people to think about the United States as a multiracial population, a multicultural society, rather than a predominantly white one.
If you look at the long-term picture of race relations, you can find some obvious improvements. But in the 20 years since this book originally came out, you do point out a few setbacks. So what are some of those things that have happened in this country that have challenged progress?
Sure. Well, if you think about the experience of a 20-year-old, someone born in 1997, if we look through the lens of that young person, one of the things we have to realize is that at the age of 4, 9/11 happened. Fast forward to 2008, you're 11 years old and the economy is collapsing. Later on in 2008, President Barack Obama was elected for the first time, and having an African American in the White House is certainly symbolically significant And many people right after the election were talking about the fact that we were in a post-racial society. I think most people would agree that we are not. But if you are 11 years old, 12, 13, watching the news, hearing that conversation, you might be thinking that race is a thing of the past, or racism is a thing of the past. You don't have to worry about that as something in your own life. Except then, 2012, Trayvon Martin is killed. And his killer is set free. And the implication of that, depending on how you've identified with Trayvon Martin, someone like you, someone not like you, will influence maybe how you're thinking about your future. 2 years later, 2014, now you are 17 years old and Michael Brown is shot in Ferguson. Ferguson is erupting. Protests are taking place on college campuses. Black Lives Matter becomes part of our common discussion. And you're thinking about, well, what does this mean for me? 2 years later, 2016, it's the presidential election and all the divisive rhetoric about immigration, the anti-immigration impulse. And then we have the election of Donald Trump. And following that election, the visible presence of white supremacists and neo-Nazis marching in places like Washington, D.C., not to mention the deadly encounters in Charlottesville. So if you have been living that reality over the course of 20 years and your sense of history is defined in that time period, 1997 to 2017, it's not very encouraging. At the same time, we know that progress is rarely linear. It's often two steps forward, one step back. And if we think about the progress of the civil rights era and now the backlash against some of that progress, the anti-affirmative action laws we see, or the assault on voting rights, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act by the Supreme Court in 2013. There are lots of examples of what I would call backward movement. And so the question that remains, and one of the issues I try to address, is what will it take for us to move forward again?
60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, many studies do show that schools are even more segregated, and you suggest that's largely because neighborhoods are segregated. The takeaway seems to be that systems are in place to just perpetuate the way that things are.
There's no question that that's what racism is, a system of advantage, and those systems are in place, and they are self-perpetuating to a certain extent. You don't have to have hate in your heart to maintain the status quo. That said, it is possible to interrupt the cycle of racism, but it does take concerted effort, and that's what we'll need to do collectively if we want to see positive, permanent change.
The epilogue of the book is titled Signs of Hope, Signs of Progress. You being so entrenched in these issues, especially over such a long period of time, was it necessary for you? Did you feel like you had to end on a note of optimism, or do you objectively see signs of hope?
Well, I am an optimistic person by nature, I will confess to that. But it was important to me, as I reflected on what had happened in the last 20 years, to point to places where progress was being made. I didn't want readers of my book to feel like, well, that's it, we may as well just stay home, nothing to be done about it. The truth of the matter is that there are always moments in history when people feel discouraged, maybe because they haven't made the progress they wanted to make or because they see signs of regression. But at the end of the day, if we look at history, what moves us forward is not sitting at home feeling bad, but rolling up our sleeves and going to work. And I wanted to lift up examples of people who were doing that, using their resources, not relying on necessarily special programs or major legislation, but people who were using the grassroots power of personal influence to make change.
Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, thank you again so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.